For our program for Green Left this week, we are going to be having a discussion with Annie White, who is an activist with Fight Back New Zealand, about the recent New Zealand election result, which has seen the Labor government led by Jacinda Ardern win an outright majority off the back of its handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. And I guess to start off this discussion, Annie, what can you tell us, I guess, about this, the electoral result in New Zealand, I guess, and its significance?
Yeah, so as you said, obviously we've had Jacinda's Labour Party get a landslide victory. This is pretty historic in terms of the scale of the victory. So it was the biggest shift in votes in a century. And it's also historic under MMP, which is the mixed member proportional system, which is a system that has generally allowed minor parties to have more influence. But this is the first time that a party under MMP is likely to be governing alone without even confidence in supply agreements or anything. And I've heard suggestions on the left that this means they can better implement a kind of a left-wing agenda. But I think the opposite is the case, because if you look at the MMP and what MMP means, it was brought in essentially because both Labor and National governments were introducing neoliberal reforms, and there was a kind of a popular support for proportional representation to curb the parties. So now with this kind of historic landslide for Labor, where they've managed to win over the middle, they're not going to want to lose the middle. And they also have no reason to be accountable to, for example, the Greens. They don't need the Greens. So yes, it means they can kind of do what they want, but it does seem like what they want is to govern for the middle. So yeah, it's a historic win, but I think probably a historic win for the centre rather than a swing to the left.
Oh, yeah. Well, going in from that, because I guess from my understanding, as a result of this, Labor now has an increased majority. And I guess looking at the last kind of election, there was this whole thing where the New Zealand government was criticised heavily because they had to govern, they had to get in a coalition with New Zealand First, which is, from my understanding, a kind of right-wing kind of nationalist party, almost akin to sort of One Nation in Australia. And I guess I want to kind of hear you kind of expand a bit more on this. How was the Jacinda Ardern government able to kind of win over this kind of centre in terms of its support base? And what can you give us a bit more of what the kind of political implications of this increased majority, which you've alluded to?
Yeah, so I mean, the winning over of the centre, in large part, it's a matter of very competent crisis management, some symbolic commitments, and an unwillingness to take any really radical measures. So in the 2017 election, they came in talking about climate change as the nuclear-free moment of our generation, but they haven't really made any sort of radical changes that are needed to address climate change. Whereas, they have won over, for example, the South Island, all of the rural seats in the South Island, party voted Labour, which is quite unusual. So they have managed to win over kind of middle voters, even conservative voters. And I think they're very aware of that. So, on the election night, there was a lot of talk of governing for all New Zealanders. And this came not just from Jacinda, but also, for example, from Grant Robertson, who's a prominent MP within the party. They both used this phrase of governing for all New Zealanders. The press very much picked that up and ran with it. And I think that very much indicates that they're saying, we will not scare the horses, we will govern for the centre. You could also see it in Jacinda's acceptance speech, when she sort of talked about how the world is polarizing and we need different sides to listen to each other. She basically said the left needs to be willing to listen to the right. So it's, yeah, very much the line has been that they've been able to win over the centre. They've probably gained votes actually from National, the right-wing opposition party. So they don't want to lose those middle voters. That's kind of very much the message that's being hammered home.
Yeah, well, I guess that gets into the next question, which is because coming from someone who's in Melbourne at the moment, one of the kind of things that has, I guess, been quite striking about Jacinda Ardern's sort of government has been its popularity and success in terms of handling, I guess, the COVID-19 pandemic, and you could argue that it's one of the best performing countries in that context. But what has, in that context, what has really been the response of the right to this electoral result, especially since I have been reading some criticisms from the right that indicate some criticism of the lockdown measures that New Zealand did, especially in relation to the classic economy?
Yeah, so I definitely think it's true that this government's handling of COVID has been very competent. You know, it's been the best in the Anglosphere in terms of just basic public health measures and being willing to apply some restrictions. And the criticisms of the right opposition have been pretty incoherent. So it's sort of been the usual. The lockdown is too restrictive. Next minute, it's not restrictive enough. The borders are too tightly policed, and then not tightly policed enough. They've really been on the attack in a fairly incoherent way. And I think even a lot of people on the right didn't like the last leader of the National Party, Judith Collins, who has always been kind of an attack dog and pretty vicious. I think Collins was kind of able to hold on to the sort of more militant elements of the National Party, but wasn't really able to win over the middle. So I think Ardern, she's really convincingly sold herself as a competent crisis manager. But then, you know, if you look at some of the measures, There are some issues with them. I mean, one of them is that they've kind of set up a two-tier benefit system where people who lost work as a result of COVID get more money than people who didn't have work prior to that. So there's a kind of a deserving and undeserving poor element to how they've designed it. They've increased police powers, which I think it's, you know, you can see why with the need for lockdown measures, but it potentially sets a bad precedent. There's been problems in terms of how migrant workers had to deal with the situation, and now they're introducing charges for returning New Zealanders. So it's not necessarily a very equitable handling of the crisis. But, I mean, it's certainly a competent handling in terms of just basic public health measures. And I think what we're seeing is there's this real worship of Jacinda internationally. And I think it's just, it's like an index of how bad things are elsewhere. You know, the fact that we've got someone like Donald Trump in the highest office in the world, really, somebody who's flagrantly racist, incompetent and ignorant. So just some kind of baseline competence and public health measures, which should be really universal, are taken as exceptional. So I guess the point is not necessarily that this is an incompetent government or what have you. It's simply that it's not a government that's willing to take any radical measures. It is a government of the centre and the middle. And I don't think people should have illusions about the nature of this government. The right, it was surprisingly self-reflective on the night, actually, that they were talking, the National Party were talking about their own failure, their own lack of discipline. A lot of a lot of talking heads were kind of prodding them to admit that Judith Collins, the leader, was part of the problem, but nobody actually stuck the knife in. But yeah, it's been a negative campaign. It drove a lot of people away, and I think they're kind of aware of that. And people are just aware that this government has handled COVID competently. That's how they were able to win over right wing and middle voters.
Yeah. Well, going respond to one of the, I guess, the points you kind of raised there. I'm kind of interested in, I guess, knowing in what the actual track record of the Jacinda Ardern administration is from a left-wing perspective, because I guess, yeah, I noticed it as well. Amongst the kind of left in Australia or even internationally, Jacinda Ardern is kind of like put forward as this, you know, amazing left-wing leader that we should all aspire to kind of be. And of course, there's even been some comparisons I've even noticed from sort of UK Labour circles, which almost somewhat see Jacinda Ardern as almost equivalent to kind of Jeremy Corbyn. So I guess want to kind of hear a bit more detail on what is the actual track record from a left-wing perspective.
Yeah, well, in terms of the UK comparison, I think the thing to consider there is that she started out her career working for Tony Blair. So, I mean, I think she's maybe comparable to Corbyn in the sense that she has a strong, she has a sort of a dedicated following, a much larger dedicated following, but still, you know, is a figure who is able to inspire and mobilize people. But her politics are certainly not Corbyn's. They're not that kind of traditional social democratic politics. And I mean, in 2017, she very much came in with lines like, again, this is that climate change is the nuclear free moment of our generation, which people may not be aware, New Zealand banned nuclear shipping in the 80s. So that's what that was a reference to. But, you know, to take that example, the example of climate change, this government introduced the zero carbon bill, but that is not really remotely adequate. They quite actively sought the input of the National Party. So basically it's a climate bill that's approved by the right. And because of that, it's inherently compromised. So it embedded the emissions trading approach, which people will be aware has created new markets and not been able to curb emissions. It excluded major emitters. It was non-binding. So it really was completely inadequate for this, but essentially species threatening situation we have right now. It was really much more of a symbolic commitment rather than being willing to take on, you know, extractive capital, agricultural capital, and make the sort of changes that are actually required to prevent runaway climate change. So yeah, that's just one example. It's been similar with Indigenous rights. So there's a land struggle called Ihu Mātou, which is basically against property developers and for a Māori kinship group, iwi, to have control of that land. And Jacinda has refused to take any explicit position on that. She's refused to even visit the site when petitioned to do so. She's really just not been willing to upset the horses on that and other issues. I mean, the Christchurch shooting is another example where, you know, she was praised for wearing the headscarf, which I can understand. And again, in an international situation where you have someone like Donald Trump leading the free world, it seems pretty exceptional for someone to simply respect Muslim customs at a funeral. But that, I think, is just a sign of how low the bar is, that simply respecting the customs at a funeral is really exceptional. But what she did after March 15th was actually beef up police powers, give police more guns. Fortunately, that trial of police having guns kind of collapsed and has been reversed after popular opposition. But I definitely think on a whole range of policy areas, it's been a very compromised government and very unwilling to take any radical measures. And I think now that they're talking about governing for all New Zealanders and they're very aware that they, you know, have this base in the middle, they're going to continue to be unwilling to really scare the horses in any way or to make any radical changes. Unless their hand is forced. I mean, again, their hand was forced on, the arming of police where there was, after Black Lives Matter, there was, quite a significant, uprising, that was also challenging, police violence, and the introduction of guns have been heavily criticized by Māori and others. So that was one thing where they were actually forced to back down and not sort of increase the arming of the police. So yeah, I think the only possibility is that their hand is forced by popular pressure, because they're not going to be curbed by the Greens, for example, in Parliament now that they're going to be governing alone.
Well, that brings up, I guess, the next question is, what is, I guess, the position of the left and, I guess, the broader social movements in relation to this new election? What are kind of some of the perspectives in terms of how they would analyse this result?
Well, there are people who called for a Jacinda vote, obviously, and people who didn't. I guess it depends who you're talking about in terms of the left. I think on what you could call the broad left, you know, not necessarily the sect left or sort of Marxist left, she's definitely beloved. I mean, it's often been quite hard to criticize her because of the sort of adulation she receives. And I think for a lot of the smaller groups, that does kind of pose a bit of a question, you know, how to respond to that constructively. I think on the broad left, there's a real, people are definitely buy into the whole Jacinda narrative. And she has, you know, she has an appealing personality. She's a competent crisis manager, but I just think we have to be fully aware that she's not going to take any radical measures, and any attempt to compare her to Bernie or to Jeremy Corbyn, I think is not really accurate. I don't think she represents that kind of polarizing politics that would be willing to frighten capital or implement major reforms. I think the left, as I say, it's the broad left is very sympathetic, and the kind of more hard left is kind of trying to figure out how to respond to the situation.
All right. That brings us, I guess, the next question is, and this will be especially of interest to our listeners, what are some of the current sort of issues and, I guess, grievances that are currently, I guess, driving kind of social movements in New Zealand right now? Like, from my knowledge, there's currently this referendum around legalising cannabis that's currently going on. I'm not sure if that has been finished up yet. And I guess, what is the position of this newly elected government in relation to some of these grievances? Is this government likely to address them? What is sort of the balance, I guess, of forces there?
Well, you mentioned the cannabis referendum, and I think that's a good example of what I've been saying, in that Jacinda has said she is not going to announce how she voted in the cannabis referendum. So, you know, even that, which is not exactly a particularly radical position, I would say now, like a lot of states have legalized marijuana, but even with that, she's not willing to take a public position. But in terms of movements, I mean, certainly historically and through to today, the Māori sovereignty movement has been a really significant element of New Zealand politics. So yeah, that goes back, well, it goes back to colonization, but, you know, you could also talk about the Māori land march in the '70s. And yeah, it has had an institutional impact as well, where there's a flawed treaty settlement process that, that has been really a concession to that social movement. And I mean, I mentioned, Ihu Mātou, which is, again, a struggle against property development of indigenous land. That triggered, protests in a number of cities. So you had, Dunedin, which is on the opposite side of the country and, you know, a fairly white, area in the south. And in Dunedin, the entire city was shut down by a protest. And, you know, you had large actions in Wellington also. And up at Ihu Mātou itself, which is near Auckland, there were protesters clashing with police. So that was quite a polarizing moment in about mid 2019. So there's a certain amount of depth that the Māori sovereignty movement has, that some other kind of, I guess, progressive and left forces don't really have. They don't have the same kind of embedding in communities. And Jacinda has just been very vague with that kind of thing. I mean, her statements about Ihu Mātou are things like, we are here when the important conversations are happening, we are listening, which is kind of, you know, she could, if she was a very different kind of political leader, she could just come out and say, this is Māori land and they have a right to decide how it's used. But obviously she's not that kind of a political leader. And I mean, I mentioned Black Lives Matter, how that, inspired, also protests in every city in New Zealand. And that kind of ties in with a, also relatively recent, movement around prison abolition and decarceration. So, there's a group of people, People Against Prisons, Aotearoa, which has, played a pretty significant role. I mean, it's a relatively small group, but it's had a reasonably big impact, in campaigning around prisoners' rights and ultimately for prison abolition. And that, with the Black Lives Matter protest setting off protests in New Zealand as well, that certainly had an impact. And as I say, the attempt to beef up police powers after the March 15th attack wasn't successful, largely because of public pressure. So yeah,
Well, I guess the next question that I wanted to kind of address, and then we can kind of conclude the interview, I guess, is the question around industrial relations, it's like the state, I guess, of the trade union movement in relation to this government and workers' rights, because I guess one of the things we noticed in Australia is the in terms of the kind of post sort of COVID kind of 19 kind of recovery, the trend of the Australian government, for example, has been basically to take away and wind back industrial relations. And of course, I also saw a recent sort of interesting sort of comment by the Marxist sort of economist Michael Roberts around the whole question around the New Zealand economy, and it's and basically the New Zealand economy will be in this position where the government will be forced to essentially give concessions to business. And I guess want to hear kind of some of your comments, I guess, on some of those kind of issues.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly over the last 30 to 40 years, the union movement has largely been obliterated in New Zealand, similar to a lot of countries after the introduction of neoliberalism. And in New Zealand, that actually started with the fourth Labour government in the 80s. who introduced a lot of radical neoliberal measures, mostly around privatization and deregulation. But then a bigger blow came from the following national government that got rid of compulsory unionism, and there were attempts to organize a general strike at that point, which were suppressed by the trade union bureaucracy. So the unions essentially shot themselves in the foot, or the leadership shot themselves in the foot, and compulsory unionism was destroyed. And not long after, you know, the unionization is at 10% of the private sector and 20% overall, including the public sector. There was really a retreat to the public sector and an unwillingness to really take militant measures on the part of the union movement for a long time. And we've seen a decline of real wages over the past 30 years. And I mentioned that's part of what triggered the struggle that resulted in MMP, mixed member proportional. And there has been some room for sort of left-wing third parties to place pressure on these issues. But I mean, through to the 2000s, you saw more organizing of hospitality workers, particularly through a group called Unite, which organized basically casual and service sector workers, and ended up focusing quite strongly on fast food, actually. And they've had some success in proving that you can organize in the sort of in the sections of the working class that are not necessarily conceived as traditionally proletarian. So, in other words, the service sector, the casual sector, young people, migrants, feminized industries. I mean, the average union member in New Zealand is a woman of colour, is a woman who's Pacifica or Māori, which very much doesn't fit with the common stereotype of the union movement. But as for this incoming government, I mean, in 2017, they sort of talked about how capitalism has failed people, sort of, but they've really stepped away from that language, and certainly not been willing to take any really radical measures. They have introduced some measures around union recognition that weren't the case under the last government. But then, for example, they also maintained what's called the Hobbit Law, which was a law that basically cast workers in the film industry, particularly actors, as independent contractors and therefore unable to unionize. And this was introduced as a union busting measure under the last government. Labour said they'd get rid of it, and they didn't. They made some amendments to it. They've also increased the minimum wage, but then, you know, the last government was also increasing the minimum wage. So it's really been more half measures. It's still not as bad as what you would get under National, but it's certainly not, again, willing to take any radical measures. We saw, a struggle, break out with the nurses, where basically the leadership had endorsed quite a dodgy deal, and there was this basically rank and file opposition to the leadership, which led to strike actions, and there was a lot of community support for the nurses. Unfortunately, in the end, after quite an inspiring struggle, they ended up with quite a poor agreement anyway, and so that was a bit unfortunate, because it's one of the few outbreaks of rank and file struggle we've really seen in some time. Another thing is with COVID, we've seen the Council of Trade Unions leadership kind of take an approach of like managerial collaboration, similar to to what's been challenged in the Australian NTEU, but there hasn't really been much of a challenge to the kind of collaborationist approach of the CTU leadership. So, yeah, I mean, again, it's this government's approach to the union movement is a little better, but certainly not willing to scare the horses, not willing to do anything that might result in capital flight. And unfortunately, the line of a lot of union officialdom is really to clamp down on any criticism of the Labor government, very much still supportive generally of the Labor Party.